Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
We've got Robert Crane.
In 3, 2, 1.
He's a Microsoft MVP, a Microsoft certified trainer, an Office 365 specialist, blogger, podcaster, social media enthusiast, and one-of-a-kind speaker who has a gift for explaining tech to the average person so they can understand it.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
There's also myself, Mark Keane. All right, let's move on. I'm the voiceover guy, producer of this podcast, blogger, speaker, and
Azure
architect,
and Microsoft
MVP who specializes in helping people with a journey to Microsoft Azure. You are listening to the
Need to Know podcast.
It's your source for the very latest in Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations all about Azure and Office 365.
My name is Reid Purvis, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
We're back. Another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and joining me on the other side of the microphone is the man who spells his name with a C, Mark Keane. Welcome.
G'day, Rob. How are you going? It's episode 144. So exciting. We're getting through these episodes.
Yeah, soon we'll be at 150 and it'll be old hat. So, again, we thank everybody for taking the time to listen to our regular podcast, getting lots of positive comments and feedback of people listening to it and our growing listener base. So
lots of people.
Very positive to see. And thanks for, again, stopping us at events and talking to us, sending us emails and letting us know that
Twitter
we're on the right track here. So don't forget our Facebook stuff as well, which will give you all the info before we dive into our guest. But before we do that, why don't we catch up on the happenings of Mr. Mark Keane and the world of Azure? What's happening, Mark?
Oh, you know, this and that. It's been pretty quiet lately. Well, for me, myself personally, but sort of been around the traps, but exploring different opportunities, as you can say, in the field of the cloud in Azure, because it's ever-changing. But what about yourself? What have you been up to in the last week?
A lot of presentations around Office 365 and Azure to customers. There is obviously a big drive now, or there's big interest in the Microsoft Teams. We have some news on that when we get to that. So that's now seems to be driving a lot of interest in the product. Microsoft keeps iterating the product, bringing more good stuff out in Azure, obviously, as well as Office 365. So there's always stuff to talk about, always stuff to do, and I'm beginning to see more and more people beginning to move away from the email side of inverted commas collaboration to more opportunities in things like SharePoint, OneDrive, Teams, Yammer, all that sort of stuff, which is great to see.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I think they're heading in the right direction, because they had quite a few different ways of collaboration before, but this new Teams option, I think, is definitely the goal, is where they're trying to head.
Well, I think it's a different paradigm for a lot of people. I think that, so let me kick off with my news since we are broaching the subject. For those who aren't aware, Microsoft Teams comes out of preview and is expected to go GA tomorrow morning, Tuesday morning in the US, which means
big news. We
should see it in our app launcher, which means it will be a button that users can now press and configure to run a team. And yeah, like you said, I think that what Teams brings is user enablement. So before, one of the limitations we've had is that IT have always said, no, you can't have this, no, you've got to have compliance, no. And users have gone, well, stuff you, we'll go and use Shadow IT, we'll use Dropbox, we'll use Slack, we'll all these free tools. So that's obviously caused major issues and headaches. So Microsoft's brought that under one umbrella in Office 365 by using things like Yammer, Groups, but they've still been a little bit disconnected. So the Teams idea is basically you name your team and it will create for you a SharePoint team site, a place to chat, a planner. All these services are automatically provisioned for the user. So not much for IT to do. Users can get on with their day and basically work inside a dedicated app, the Teams app. So I think this is, again, a major shift in sort of the power base when it comes to rolling out provisioning IT. It's moving from a IT admin, you know, control of the equipment to a place where users now can basically provision everything, get up and running ASAP.
Sounds like it's a good option for the users because they don't have to rely on IT. It sort of brings shadow IT to the next level. It's like originally IT didn't want to set it all up. They were sort of worried and they said, no. But now this has come out, users can easily set up a team. It sets it up for them. Who needs IT now?
Well, I think the thing is that the difference is that provisioning, yes, I agree with you. Users can go in, they click a button, and off it goes. But IT still needs to have compliance, oversight, and support it. Now, what I'm finding is that unfortunately a lot of resellers aren't up to speed with Teams. They still are very poor with SharePoint. So the user sets it up, needs some help moving documents or needs some help adding permissions or building out the SharePoint site, and the reseller still doesn't really have a good idea. So there is certainly a role for IT, but it's moving them more into the management rather than the provisioning. I think a lot of the provisioning has been held up by, again, resellers and IT pros who probably don't have the skill set to understand how to provision this stuff. So Microsoft basically has done that for the user using the Teams concept, and I would suggest that we'll see down the track more and more things like Staff Hub also be rolled into a team. So when you roll select a team, you'll get the option to say, do you want a Staff Hub scheduling set up for this as well? You tick yes, and it will also give you a Staff Hub. The downside probably is the systems aren't quite as integrated as we want. There's a little bit of confusion around what's a team, what's a team site, what's a group. That still has to be a little bit tidied up, I think, in the back end from Microsoft, but I'm sure that will come. But the main thing is it gets users up and running, gives them a SharePoint site, gives them an email list, gives them a shared calendar, a planner, gives them everything they need to get up and running. The other interesting thing in all of this probably is what's the fate of Yammer? So Yammer is the social network that is part of Office 365. Is it being replaced by Teams? Is it being integrated? I think that we'll see Yammer remain as a standalone product because it does serve a very good feature if you're just looking to do enterprise-style social networking. But in the long run, I think that the features will end up in Teams.
We did warn IT pros that their jobs were dead-end jobs. We did warn to transition to learn PowerShell or something else just to get into that more of close into the developer sort of a stage where you can make a difference and you can sort of develop and be more creative and
I think the opportunity is there with products like Flow, products like Power Apps, using those more and more every day to automate processes. Part of that means a little bit of programming or a little bit of development, as you mentioned, and they're great opportunities to get into. They're going to become more and more powerful, but I think that the position of the IT pro isn't disappearing, it's transitioning, and that means that, why should an IT pro really worry about provisioning a SharePoint site? The user just clicks a button, away you go. So they're still
going to... Or
a PowerShell script. They need to obviously manage it, do the permissions, grow it out, but there still isn't a huge amount of knowledge around products apart from email and Office 365 in my experience, and that, again, is holding the product back, and that's why users are being given these enablement tools to help them get on and use all the features in the product.
Yeah, excellent. Smart move on Microsoft's side.
Okay, what about some Azure stuff?
Well, ARM. So if I say ARM, what do you think of that, or what do you know about ARM?
So it's the bit between my shoulder and my wrist, no?
No.
Oh, so I think it's something to do with computers. What about Windows RT, maybe? Does that ring a bell?
You sure it's not me saying, what's next?
Well, why don't you just tell us what it means in Azure terms?
Well, there's two meanings in this respect. So there's ARM on ARM. So ARM in Azure is Azure Resource Manager. And the other ARM is the processor. It's ARM-based processor. So Microsoft is moving beyond Intel CPUs in its Azure cloud. And they're going to start using ARM-based servers in its Azure cloud. Microsoft has been testing Windows Server running on ARM-based servers made by Qualcomm and Cavium. They are testing Qualcomm's ARM-based 10-nanometer Centric 2400 processor available up to 48 cores. They plan on using ARM-based servers to run search, storage, machine learning, and big data-related tasks. More than 9 out of 10 of the world's smartphones run on ARM-based processors. They've not really penetrated the data center market as yet, because Intel has lowered the energy in their CPUs to date. Intel estimates its processors are inside 98% of the cloud-based servers. Last year, Intel's data center group reported $17.2 billion in sales and $7.5 billion operating profit. That they're going to get a shake up, I would imagine, with these new ARM-based servers coming in.
So what's the benefit of ARM? Why would you go to ARM?
Well, it's low powered, and plus I think it is cheaper as well. So they do have a purpose. I don't know if you remember the original Surface 1, not the Surface Pro, but just the plain Surface before the, you know, the original one right at the beginning,
yeah,
the
one
that couldn't
run
any 30.
I've got one sitting on my desk. I think you're talking about a Surface RT, not a.
Yeah, that's it.
One. That's correct.
That runs a ARM-based processor.
Yeah, the idea here is, as I understand, ARM also has a reduced instruction set, which makes it a simpler processor, less power, as you mentioned, cheaper to make, but also executes instructions faster because it's got less overhead.
Yeah, correct. There is another difference, which I can't think of at the moment, but yeah, it does have.
It's interesting. So we're moving from
place in the market.
Moving from a place of data center of lots and lots of PCs to lots and lots of cell phones. I mean, you can obviously put a lot more cell phones in a data center than you can PCs. But it's very interesting, isn't it, when you think about what's actually running all this stuff in the back end. It doesn't really matter, does it? And again, it will probably mean that the prices will continue to fall.
Yeah, well, we hope. They'll pass on the savings. I mean, that's all part of competition, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly right. So, ready for some more Office 365 stuff, or...?
Hit me with it.
Hit you with it. Okay, so Microsoft is introducing a new profile experience in Office 365. So the profile typically you set up in something like Dell. So you go in there and you tell people about your what you've done, your skills, your CV, basically a bit like a LinkedIn. And now when you mouse over many of the documents or applications in Office 365, you get a bit of a mini profile. Microsoft is now updating that so that we can see not only the contact details about, but we'll also see the recent files. So it brings a bit of the Dell side of it in to the profile and makes it much cleaner and much simpler for people to look at. So again, look at that to start rolling out to your tenant. And another interesting thing that they're bringing into Office 365, so when we go to our SharePoint area in Office 365, we currently get a list of our favorite sites, our frequent sites, but what Microsoft are bringing to us are that they are rolling the news so that sites in Office in SharePoint have a news widget that you can post up news about that team, that area. That news is now being aggregated into the SharePoint entry page, so we'll see news from all the different sites in a little section at the top of the general SharePoint page. So again, makes it a great place for users to start their day. If they're involved in multiple teams, they will see all the news feeds for those multiple teams displayed in the SharePoint entry page. So some cool stuff that Microsoft are adding, continuing to iterate along.
Very nice. On the Azure side of things, Microsoft have announced the preview of the latest edition of Azure SQL Service to use. So premium RS and a 4 terabyte increase of storage limits for premium P11 and P15. So premium RS is designed to run IO intensive workloads that need premium performance but do not require the highest availability guarantees. Also, you can now use up to 4 terabytes of storage with P11 and P15 premium databases at no additional charge. More info to that in the show notes. And coming up soon to a town near you, if you're living in Australia, essentially, a couple of events happening. So the Visual Studio 2017 launch event is happening. So in case you haven't heard, Visual Studio 2017 is now available, and to celebrate the occasion, there's a Visual Studio 2017 launch event. Microsoft will be celebrating the launch with the latest version, as well as 20 years of Visual Studio. There will be a team from Microsoft, Xamarin, Redify, all of those guys together. They'll be sharing the latest innovations in Visual Studio .NET, Xamarin, Azure, plus much, much more. It'll be a day packed with technical demo sessions to help you get the most out of Visual Studio 2017. Basically, they're going to run through what's new, DevOps session, C# 7.0, so the new version of C#, mobile application development with Visual Studio 2017, and then App Insights and Test Hub. and they'll be putting on morning tea, lunch, and afternoon tea as well. It goes for one day, happening in Sydney, Canberra, Perth. At the end of this month, you can reserve your spot by clicking on a link we'll put in the show notes. It'll be in my blog site. Also, too, if you're a female and you're listening to this podcast, there's another event happening called Tech Femme Sydney. It's for women. It's a unique event designed to inspire and empower young women from STEM-based backgrounds. Rob, what is STEM?
Science, technology, engineering, and manufacturing, is it?
Maths.
Maths. Close.
Close. Well done. Happening on Thursday, March 20, this month, from 4:45 p.m. till 8:30 p.m. at the University of Technology Sydney in Ultimo. So there's a link to that in the show notes in my blog site as well. Also to something else which has come about, and I'm pretty excited about this one, PowerShell version 6.0.0. So in case you're not keeping up, PowerShell version 5 is included part of Windows 10. And since PowerShell has now been open source, there is now a brand new version that you can install on your computer. There's a whole bunch of new changes and updates as well. So it's up to version 6 now, thanks to the collaboration of open source community. More info to that, there's a link in the show notes as well.
Is the version 6 RTM or is it in preview?
It's out.
Yep.
It's there, you can download it.
It's RTM.
For different operating systems, yep. It's all there. There's links in GitHub and stuff like that we can get the bits from.
Okay. All right, we look forward to installing that and playing with that, seeing how well that works. So some more Office 365 stuff here. Microsoft has also evolved, as they say in their blog post, the advanced threat protection with URL detonation and dynamic delivery. So Office threat, advanced threat protection is something that comes typically with E5, or you can buy it as a standalone SKU. What it does effectively is it will open suspect attachments in a sandbox virtual machine before the user has a chance to open it on their production machine and check for the malicious software. It can also monitor links, so the way that people basically get users into downloading malware is to send them a link. It looks good when it goes through the initial filters, but then they change it at the back end and make it point to somewhere that's bad. So Microsoft Advanced Threat Protection will monitor that and also alert users whether that has changed and they shouldn't probably click it. So again, blog post in there. If you've got E5, again, a great advanced option that they are building into this product, and it's always good to have more security, especially when we have all these zero-day attacks that seem to get
Rob,
straight through. Yep.
That's all well and good, and I do get that whole advanced threat protection thing, but here's the thing, right? If I've got a computer and I get a dodgy email, me being IT, I know if it's dodgy or not. Now, if I've got that advanced threat protection turned on, I'm putting all my trust into Microsoft. Now, I could click on that link knowing that I've got it turned on and think, yeah, I'm safe. Just do it on purpose just to test it, to see how it works. But there's no way of actually knowing until you've clicked on it. And if it doesn't work, then it's too late and your computer's screwed.
Well, part of it is that these days that it is almost impossible for most people to be able to test some of these things. And I think Microsoft using machine learning, using the interaction with other providers to at least warn you is a really good thing. And again, I think if you haven't had a look at advanced threat protection, what it can do for you, the advanced safety features it offers, again, I think that having some sort of protection in front of your email servers is a good thing, and the more you have, the better, and the ability to protect against safely malicious links and also malicious attachments, so typical crypto locker stuff, is a very good thing. So I think you'll find that putting this in front certainly will cut down. Nothing can eliminate the chance of, you know, something bad getting through, but from what I understand, the advanced threat protection is very, very good and will certainly give you a much higher level of protection and security. So I would certainly trust the advanced threat protection much more than I would trust an AV from a third-party provider on the desktop. I just think those things are too old, too reactive, too bloated, and just don't do the job. So again, my vote would go for advanced threat protection over a local AV.
Yep. Yep, I agree. Now, golden rule, like being IT people, if we see a dodgy email, just because we've got advanced threat protection turned on, golden rule, still don't click on it, don't even trust it, don't open it. Now, it's, I guess it's there for the average user out there, which doesn't understand the dodginess behind emails and stuff like that, and they'll click on the email no matter what. But because it's turned on, hopefully with any luck, it'll capture up to 100% of those nasty emails. So it's more of a protection for users who sort of don't know what they're doing.
Well, I think, again, the idea here is, I mean, you know, like you said, most times the IT is, oh, this is dodgy, you know, you'll see it. But I will, again, relay a message that doing a lot of traveling, getting a lot of confirmations of flights, you receive a PDF, you know, invoice or whatever.
Heaps.
Yeah, again, they use that and they send it to you and it looks exactly official. And if you are flying and you're expecting that coming through, it's very easy to click on. It's only when you look at it and think, hang on, I'm not going to that location, I'm actually going somewhere else, that you pick it up. So nobody's immune, and I think the more protection you have, like driving a car, additional airbags, ABS, all that sort of stuff, makes it much safer, especially for users who just want to get on with their job. The other side of the coin here is, don't forget that some businesses get absolutely flooded with these sort of things for whatever reason. They absolutely get flooded, and a lot of people just can't keep up with that sort of deluge. So I think that having something, the more protection in front, the better. Again, the best sort of protection is educated users, but unfortunately not all users can be educated to the same level. So I think it's worthwhile, and you should certainly have a look at it. And remember, it is part of the 5. It is available to you, and it does have a lot of additional options that really make things a lot more secure and should allow IT pros managing systems to sleep better at night.
If in doubt, and you get an email come through using, you know, the web-based version of your email, if in doubt, use somebody else's computer and test it on that.
And that's exactly what Microsoft's doing with advanced.
At least keeps you safe.
Well, that's what Microsoft's doing with advanced threat protection. They open it in their own VMs, which I believe are hosted on Azure. They see what the attachment does, whether it changes the registry or starts encrypting files, and they make a decision on it. So effectively, it's the same sort of thing, but you're just using Microsoft's computers rather than some poor unsuspecting employee that's probably not going to speak to you after you infect their machines and the whole network on their behalf. So some other stuff here I've got is that we're seeing basically a very interesting article I found in the local news, also in the Sydney Morning Herald, our newspaper here in Sydney, about a dire warning for people who drive cars for a living. So basically, there was a tech summit, and a lot of the tech people are saying, well, look, you know, the first jobs to go in this digital revolution are probably going to be people who drive for a living, so truck drivers, delivery people. And one of the things they're calling for on the government is to say, well, you know, what are you doing to help re-educate these people, to help them get into other opportunities? So
should be up to them.
Well, it's very interesting. I think that it's I'm seeing more and more of these style of articles, more and more people beginning to appreciate that we are at the beginning of what could be see a major shift in the demographics when it comes to work, comes to jobs. So something to think about, something to look at. Again, we talked about the need to upskill for IT pros around products like Office 365 and Azure. That certainly goes hand in hand with the environment. I know that there are a lot of things to keep up with, but again, that's why you're listening to this podcast, hopefully.
Well, if people weren't idiots, if people drove properly in the first place, we wouldn't have this problem of people trying to, like, automate cars. I mean, that's the reason why I'm doing it, to reduce the idiots on the road.
Would you like to share your number plate so that people can actually discuss this with you when they are driving their vehicles on Sydney roads? If you don't, then I'm happy to share that with people. Send me an email and I'll let you know all Mark's driving details so that you can comment on it and post on our Facebook page about how well he does as a driver. Rate me on their podcast.
That's right. So what Rob's trying to say is that it's all about networking. He's trying to network out with everybody. But speaking of networking, networking innovations, driving cloud disruption. So as you know, Microsoft Azure has a massive data center infrastructure behind them with robust and secure networks. Microsoft's goal is to offer cloud services that any customer anywhere in the world doesn't have to worry about capacity constraints or service quality, and to be able to get their resources from anywhere at any scale with no limitations, easily and securely. When Microsoft started developing cloud offerings, they quickly realized that the traditional networking approach wouldn't give the speed, reliability, and security needed by customers. Microsoft has been innovating and heavily investing in network infrastructure. They built a scalable and flexible data center network, which uses virtualized layer 3 overlay network. It's an independent network of the physical network topology. So multiple virtual networks run on the same physical network in the data centers, similar to multiple virtual machines on the same physical server. So yeah, similar to a Hyper-V host or a hypervisor, each customer has their own isolated virtual network. So Microsoft have replaced hardware load balancers with standard compute servers that run the Azure load balancer. Microsoft have built a backbone network that spans the globe, laying undersea cables to Europe and Asia. Microsoft have invested in these undersea cables, which run from North America to Ireland and on to the United Kingdom. Also, a physical landing station in the US connecting North America to Asia via the new cross-Pacific cable network, which is up right now. It's live. Azure VMs have up to 25 gigabits per second bandwidth with very low latency in each region. Servers running in the Azure data centers have special network cards that offload network processing to the hardware. Both Linux and Windows machines will experience performance improvements while returning valuable CPU cycles to the applications which need them most. And more info to that in the show notes. And speaking of networks, Rob, we got one here, Sonic. So the networking switch software that powers the Microsoft Global Cloud. As Microsoft has gained a lot of insight into building and managing a global, high-performance, highly available and secure network, their experience with hundreds of data centers and tens of thousands of switches tells them that basically they need the best switching hardware. They need to deploy new features without impacting users. They got to roll out updates securely. It's a massive task that they're tasked with. Also utilize cloud scale deep telemetry and fully automated failure mitigation. There's a whole bunch of things which I've got to sort of take care of and put into consideration. So to address all these things, Microsoft have pioneered software for open networking in the cloud, which is SONiC for short. It's a breakthrough for networking switch operations and management, and how Microsoft has open sourced this innovation to the community, making it available on their SONiC GitHub repository. And SONiC is a uniquely extensible platform built on the switch abstraction layer interface, which defines a standardized API. Network hardware vendors can use it as well if they want to help develop and innovate hardware platforms that can achieve great speeds while keeping performance interface to the ASIC specification, which is application specific integrated circuit. Keep it ASIC consistent. So there you go. So Microsoft's doing some great things in the networking space moving forward because they've got no choice. They are growing at a massive rate and they've got to keep up with the demands of the cloud and especially everybody using it and stuff, and they can't have any downtime. They can't afford anything like that. So they've had to come out and innovate as well. There's a whole bunch more things that they're doing as well, innovating with the servers and the updates. I won't go into that in detail now, but there are a lot of patents online, which if you could Google search Mark Rusinovich patents, you'll come across a whole bunch of them, which he's put through in the IaaS space for Azure. Some nice little patents that don't require any more reboots, or he's reduced the amount of reboots required for servers and hardware hypervisors when it comes to updating and patching and stuff, so they don't need to do a, you know, like the old school restart. They can do a restart of different little areas of the operating system, and they're passing that on to the consumer, to the customer, by offering the SLA on the single instance SLA on virtual machines with premium storage. So that's all coming through. So they're making inroads and they're coming ahead in leaps and bounds with a whole bunch of nice little updates and changes themselves.
All right, well,
the true pioneers they are.
I've got one for you. Have you heard about the Global Azure Bootcamp 2017 yet?
Yes, I've heard about that. Hasn't it been on already?
No, they're still running.
It's coming up very soon.
They're running them all around the world, so we'll put the link in the show notes. So if you are interested in attending a global, one of the boot camps they're running around the world, lots and lots of places, Sydney, Perth, Brisbane, Melbourne, as well as New Zealand, all over the US and Europe, Basically sign up for that, and again you'll get some really great information about Azure driven by the local user groups. So another point from me before we start rounding up for this episode is I have also released a new cloud lecture series into my CIA Ops Academy. So ciaopsacademy.com.au. In there, I've taken a lot of recordings that I've done over recent presentations, and I put them up there for free. So you can sign up. You'll get information on cloud business, Office 365, and things like Azure. I continue to add recordings, so the more presentations that I do, I generally try and record those, chop them up, put them also with some video around some the slides that I use, and making that available for free. So you'll find that at ciaopsacademy.com.au called the Cloud Lecture Series. I'll put the link to that directly in the show notes. Encourage you to sign up and basically get the presentations on a lot of the stuff that I'm doing around the traps for free. Don't forget that you can also provide some feedback, some questions in our various options. So we have our Facebook group at N2K Podcast. We also have a Twitter handle of the same name, N2K Podcast. We have some email addresses. What's the best email address for people to contact us, Mark?
It is feedback at neetano.cloud is the email address.
Excellent. All right, so we encourage people to do that. We've had some great feedback from a number of people. We appreciate. Don't forget the iTunes review. We also need to shout out to our friends at Rode to let them know that the microphones we use provide such great quality and provide some really, really high-level, I suppose, productions that we are doing. Mark's very wrapped in that, aren't you, Mark?
High fidelity. That's Rob, I was going to say, your presentations that you're recording and then you're chopping them up. So I live by quality. I only want quality. So I'm assuming that these presentations that you're doing, your voice is as good as it is right now?
Not quite, because obviously we're in a big room, but I'm certainly using one of the Rode portable mics.
That's right. Plugged That's exactly what I was meant to hear.
Yeah, exactly. Plugged into my local, in the phone. And it's surprising the quality. I must admit that, again, a normal thing just clipped to the lapel works really, really well. So, again, have a listen. Let us know what you think. We're obviously using standard desktop-based mics here, but the roaming mic works really well. The next, attempt I'm going to make using that microphone is to try it in the car. So hands-free, obviously. Clip it on the old lapel and drive somewhere and have some thoughts and share those with people. So we'll see how that goes in the car.
That'll work quite well, I reckon.
Because a lot
of soft stuff in the car to soak up noise and waveforms and stuff. So you wouldn't get much echo.
It'll be interesting to see because, modern cars obviously are very quiet inside generally, very well made. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see you have got the traffic outside. We'll record that and I'll see how that goes, put that up and have some thoughts there. But it certainly makes the ability to record this stuff very, very easy. The mic's very small, travels with me everywhere, easy to operate, plug into any smartphone. And again, get that high-level quality that you can then produce into whatever you want. So certainly recommend that. Purchased it from a local electronics store, so really easy to obtain and a good addition to the desktop-based mic we use for this podcast.
Excellent. Look forward to seeing that or hearing that car cast when it comes out on YouTube.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's call it the CarCast, and we can follow Mark around as people express their interest in his driving. So we'll provide that as well. So anything else from you before we sign off?
Nope, that's pretty much it. That's all the stuff in the Azure space.
All right, so we encourage people again to give us some feedback also on things like iTunes and Stitcher. Make sure that you share the podcast around with your peers. Obviously, we're looking to grow this podcast so that we can get more people on board and make it more enticing to sponsorship. So one of the things we're aiming to do this year is hopefully get some sponsors on board to provide us some additional funds to grow this and take it to the next level, provide more quality and also some more information for users. But I think with that, I'm all done. Mark's all done. So let's get into our special guest.
We're heading into CSP, licensing.
Why not?
The hot topic it is. And we've got Andrei Korenkov from, can I say which company you're from, right, Andrei?
Oh, I don't know. Can you, Mark?
All right. Well, do you want to introduce to the folk who you are, where you're from, and what you do, etc.?
Sure. So I'm Andrei Korenkov. I'm a partner enablement specialist at Ripe, the cloud channel company. I launched and maintained the Microsoft Cloud Solution Provider program for them in Australia and in five countries in Southeast Asia. So I work primarily with service provider partners.
So you kept very, very busy.
Incredibly busy, Mark.
I think traveling a lot.
This year alone, I've already racked up about 23 flights.
Wow. We've also got Rob here as well. And Robert Crane, as always, our regular podcaster, my sidekick.
Oh, thanks. Thanks to be your sidekick now. Just plain Jane, Robert. That's fine. I'll stand in the background here and I'll let you two waffle on about CSP and interject occasionally. Don't let me stop you.
All right. Well, that's exactly right. We're here to talk about CSP and the good old CSP licensing. So, Rob, how about you kick off with the first questions?
All right, Andre. So I think that one of the biggest changes that we have seen in the partner space has been this change to the CSP model. And obviously, it's something that Microsoft's very focused on, getting partners to adopt and enable. So in a nutshell, can you give us basically the changes that CSP has brought to the licensing landscape for things like Office 365 and Azure?
So I think one of the biggest changes is that Microsoft is allowing the partners now to own the entire customer relationship from beginning to end. Partners are always selling Office 365, but Microsoft would often do the billing. So through WebDirect, would that actually charge the customer and give the partner an incentive rebate on a quarterly basis. The CSP program now allows the partner to bill their customers and set their own margins. The difference between what most partners are used to now under the open licensing program is that you retain all flexibility, that it's monthly billing rather than annual billing like you have with open. So it gives you the benefits of both worlds.
So again, there's obviously open and there's also direct, with this credit card purchasing typically purchased by the customer. So what are you seeing out there? Are you seeing more people move from the direct billing and the open into CSP? Is there a major move that way for partners?
Yeah, they're coming off of both. I probably think most partners have been selling under WebDirect from what I've seen. And coming into the CSP program, the benefit for those partners is customers didn't actually put down their credit cards. It was the partner that would put their credit card down, get billed, and then roll that invoice into all of their other services to their customers. The partner wore a credit risk and quite hefty admin overheads because they were reconciling multiple invoices for all of their customers every single month. So they were quite happy to jump into the CSP program to reduce their admin overhead. Partners that were selling open licensing, they're coming into CSP primarily for the flexibility of the program, that they don't have to sell a year in advance. They can sell on a quarterly or a monthly basis with daily proration to the customers.
All right, so if a partner is out there and they're using their credit card for a customer, obviously with the issues that that raises and causes for their business cash flow wise, how do they become part of the CSP program? What's the process they've got to do from the standard model they're using on the credit card to jump into this new world?
Yeah, so for a partner like that, it's actually quite simple. You need to be a Microsoft Partner Network member and have already signed the Microsoft Online Services Partner Agreement. If you're selling directly on credit card, you already have those two things. So to come into the CSP program, you just need to find a two-tier distributor like Ripe or one of the many others out there in the wild, and we can transition those licenses from advisor into CSP, and then the partner can start benefiting from a single invoice for all their customers once a month straight away.
Okay, so if I was a end user and I basically was using pay-as-you-go, for example, and I wanted to move across to CSP, could I then, what's the best way? Could I just jump online to the Azure portal and change licensing and follow my nose to CSP licensing or something? Or
as a customer, you can't. You need to find a partner that is engaged with a two-tier CSP, like a distributor effectively, and have them do the transition for you. So the CSP program is very partner focused. So it's for partners to sell to customers. So unlike the web direct model, whether it's a direct sale effectively from Microsoft to the end user, this is partner to end user.
Okay, you might want to talk about and explain very carefully the different levels here before we get too further into it, because you've got two-tier, one-tier, you've got partners, and then also, too, there's different types of partners. There's partners of Microsoft, there's partners of Ripe, and things like that. So if you can just explain the different levels and how they all integrate with one another.
Oh, what do you mean? Like, it's...
like, for example, Ripe's a two-tier CSP versus a one-tier CSP.
Yeah, so one-tier CSPs are generally telcos. So those that were syndication partners, Telstra is a perfect example, they've now become one-tier CSPs. So one-tier is effectively they're buying from Microsoft and they're selling direct to the customer. To be in the one-tier program, you do have to have quite a large commitment of seats every year. The two-tier program is Microsoft to a distributor like Ripe that then sell to a partner or a service provider that then sells to their customer. The benefit to the service providers there is they don't have any seat commitments to Microsoft. They can sell one seat, they can sell 1,000 seats. There's no commitment there. And the distributor, in my case Ripe, we wear that growth target with Microsoft.
Okay, is there any other benefits? How does support come into it? Because I remember like using BPOS back in the day and calling up support. It was Telstra support. And it was sort of frustrating at best trying to get support out of that sort of BPOS days with Office 365. This is going back about 3 or 4 years ago. How does the whole support part of it come into this whole equation with CSP in two-tier and one-tier?
The support's an interesting thing. Microsoft will still handle all escalations. So if the service is actually down and not working at a service level, that's something that can be raised with Microsoft. They'll assist the partner in that instance. They don't actually provide support to the end users anymore. That is expected of the partner to deliver that service. So the partner would own the support relationship and they'd only lean onto Microsoft when there is a problem with the service itself.
Okay, Andre, so we've talked about CSP in Office 365, but one of the things I see, a lot of partners don't appreciate the depth that CSP is also available across other Microsoft products. So in the CSP world, what products, aside from Office 365, can partners take advantage of via CSP?
Well, we have the entire online services catalog from Microsoft available in the CSP program, so Office 365, Dynamics, all the way into Azure and everything in between.
Okay, so we're sort of seeing a whole range of the online stuff going to the CSP model. I mean, in terms of the uptake, are the majority of partners just doing Office 365, or now are you seeing more and more of them starting to do things like Azure, CRM, EMS, all that sort of stuff?
Look, CRM is a pretty big component. There's been quite a lot of interest and growth in that since Dynamics 365 came about in the last couple of months. EMS is still, it's a high growth product, but it's still fairly low seat count compared to things like Dynamics 365. Where I'm seeing maybe a lot of growth right now is in Azure. A lot of partners... we're quite hesitant to adopt Azure on the credit card or the open licensing program just because of the administrative or billing difficulties they're facing, and CSP's cleared that up for them. So the uptake there has accelerated much, much more than any of the other products.
Okay, so we've talked about the changeover from the advisor model or the credit card model into CSP and the licensing and how a partner will go about that. But let's say that a partner wants to move a customer from an existing CSP to their own CSP. Is that fairly straightforward to achieve now?
What do you mean from CSP to
CSP? So, for example, if they pick up a customer who had one reseller and their CSP and they want to now put in their own CSP and replace the existing one. Is that straightforward to do? How much work's involved in basically changing the CSP provider if a reseller brings on or picks up an existing customer who already has CSP?
Yeah, so the CSP program is really flexible. It can mix and match different programs and different partners. So quite a common scenario is to have one partner provide licenses via CSP to a customer for, say, Office 365, and you may have another partner with the same customer using the same program, CSP, either with potentially with a different distributor. They can provide Dynamics 365 because that's something they can specialize in. And you might even have a third partner in there providing services on Azure through a different program even. They could provide it under an enterprise agreement. So the program doesn't really actually have a lot of limitations, and it's very, very flexible. You can mix and match partners, and you can mix and match the programs that the services are purchased on. The only thing that's inflexible is customers that are still on syndication, so they're with Telstra in a Telstra environment, not in the CSP program yet, they're stuck in that bubble. But once they leave syndication, they can mix and match whichever program suits them at any time.
So I think the good news about that bubble is it is deflating quite rapidly, and Telstra is moving more and more clients across to a CSP model, giving the reseller the flexibility. But what about when it comes to the contract terms? Like a reseller comes in, provides CSP to their customer. You did mention month by month, but is there basically any 12-month contract or ongoing contract that the reseller is liable for when they use CSP with a customer?
Well, those terms and conditions do vary from CSP to CSP. There is no agreement between the end customer and Microsoft anymore, so those terms and conditions are dictated by the partner providing the service. And then that partner's agreement between the CSP is different again. So Rhipe offers all the flexibility of the CSP program to our partners. There is a 12-month commitment to purchase a product, but what you're not locked into is the quantity. So a partner could sell 20 licenses, and they can go up and down, even down to one license, and that would still be within the terms of the agreement. Now, with that, right now, a partner can terminate a CSP agreement at any time with no financial repercussions. However, Microsoft does have a clause in their agreement that they can enforce early termination fees. However, for the last 2 years, they've chosen not to do that. And it doesn't look likely like they will have any termination fees coming into the program.
Okay, so moving people from one place to another, let's talk about that for a sec. So, for example, if I was a company and I had, say, a CSP licensing agreement with another provider, for example, and I wanted to move across to, say, Rhipe, for example, it's all my VMs and all my services are within that one subscription. Is it as easy as just in the back end, just flicking across the licensing and then everything just remains the same?
With Azure,
or does it have to be moved across?
Azure or Office 365?
Let's focus on Azure.
Yeah. So Azure can be a difficult one. That just really comes down to the services and what the Microsoft platform supports. So virtual machines, storage accounts, virtual networks, those services can be moved between subscriptions with no issue. The challenge you come into is that some of the services that Microsoft has in Azure, Microsoft does not support moving subscriptions or regions or resource groups. The most common ones are VPN gateways. You provision the VPN gateway, you can't move that between a subscription. So what you'd need to do in that instance is remove the VPN gateway, move the virtual machines to a new subscription, and reprovision the VPN gateway. So that's quite easy to overcome. Where you really start coming into roadblocks and difficulties is things like recovery services. So backup and start recovery. Microsoft does not support those services moving between subscriptions. site recovery, not a huge problem because you reset up site recovery in the new subscription. Once you do your initial synchronization, you're back to where you were. With backup, you can do the same, but you lose the historical backup data.
Okay, so just to clarify, talking about moving between subscriptions, are we talking about moving between subscriptions within the same tenant, or is it to the point you can move between subscriptions across tenants?
If you have one CSP subscription, then you move into another CSP subscription.
Yeah, that'd be different tenants, would they, or the same tenant?
That would be within the same tenancy. So, with Azure and CSP, the Azure subscription is given to the same tenancy as to where the Office 365 subscription resides.
Right.
So, when you have another CSP partner coming in and giving you an Azure subscription, that would go into the same tenant as the other subscription. Whereas on other programs, like Advisor or Open, you had a choice of putting into a tenancy or provisioning Azure under a personal account. So you had a lot of difficulties transitioning those older subscriptions. But under CSP, it would all be part of the same tenancy for that customer.
Okay, so if we go back to like moving, say, a customer from an old CSP provider, like another CSP provider, so provider A, to say another completely different provider B, CSP provider, to move that subscription across, it would be a different, say, tenant, for example. Is there any challenges about moving Azure resources, like VMs or anything else, web services, from one subscription to another across tenants?
No, well, if it's the same customer and you got two CSPs, both of those subscriptions would be in the same tenancy. They would not be in separate tenants. So
okay.
You're moving from one subscription to another within the same tenant. So you can go into the portal, onto the resource, and click Change Subscription, choose the other subscription from your other CSP, and move the resource.
Okay.
The intricacies come about is some services, Microsoft supports that, and others they don't. So virtual machines, VNets, storage accounts, they can be moved, provided there's no VPN gateway. If there's a VPN gateway, that service, Microsoft does not allow to be moved. So what you need to do in that instance is detach the VPN, move the services, the IP addresses, virtual machines, everything, and reprovision a new VPN gateway in the new subscription.
Okay, so do you guys, I guess my final question, and Rob, I'll hand it back over to Rob, is the final question is, you guys take care of all of those sort of intricacies of moving people across from one subscription to another?
We do. There's quite a lot of intricacies in that, and it's something that Ripe has chosen to do on behalf of partners. We'll work with them to gain access to the subscriptions and effectively move them from one subscription to another. It's something that is very finicky from a Microsoft perspective, and given that we do this day in, day out, we understand the challenges and how to get around them a lot better than partners, and that just really removes the burden from partners to have to do this finicky work themselves.
Okay, excellent. Rob, over to you.
Okay, so part of the older model when it came to partners was that they would sign a partner up and become what was known as partner of record. They then received trailing commissions for that based on the sales. That was changed in October last year, where partners now are incentivized around the adoption of the suite. Now, if I go through the CSP model, what happens to the partner of record? Does the partner of record automatically get put into the tenant? Am I still the partner of record for the CSP clients that I set up?
You are, yes. So it's now called a reseller record of reseller ID. So it's effectively like the partner of record. So in terms of counting towards the competencies, that all still applies. The one piece that's missing is the quarterly rebates you get from Microsoft. That was effectively your margin. What's happening now is you're making that margin directly on the sale. So that's the only part that changes. All the other incentives that you get with partner of record, you still receive that. In the CSP program, it's just called reseller of record rather than partner of record.
Okay, so that's good clarification for people. Now, the other one also that partners utilize to manage their customers' environments is delegated admin. Is there any changes to that? Are we still delegated admin? Does that automatically get set up when we do CSP?
Delegated admin has never been automatically set up, so the partner has to ask the customer for permission for delegated administration rights. The customer needs to grant that to the partner, and they still access the tenancy through delegated admin as they did in the past. Essentially, when you move from Advisor, Open, EA, or any program that's not syndication into CSP, effectively, the only thing that changes is how you buy the licenses and how they're built. The actual technical side of the tenancy, how you administer the customers, all of that remains the same.
Okay, so what about the trials that you can push out as a delegated admin or as a partner to people? When you push out a trial, how does that work? Is that the same as any changes when it comes to sending that out for potential customers?
That's still exactly the same. So you still create a trial offer in the Partner Admin Center, send that to your customer or activate it on their behalf. The change really happens is when the customer is ready to purchase, rather than putting down a credit card with Microsoft or buying an open license, you would just purchase that license under CSP.
Okay, so what about the move from something like Open to CSP? Obviously, Open is generally a timed agreement over 12 months, 3 months. Can we move midterm in an open license agreement? Do we have to wait for that to terminate? How can we handle that transition from an open arrangement into a CSP?
Okay, so you can move into the CSP program at any time with open licensing. When you get a license, you pay for it 12 months in advance. So what actually happens when you come into CSP, the license, if you have 6 months left on it, it stays there. It keeps working for another 6 months. What you can do is if you want to buy an additional product, you can buy the additional product under CSP. So you can mix and match open and CSP licensing in the same tenancy. What you would then do is once the open license comes up for expiration or renewal, you would just purchase that through the CSP program rather than renewing the open license.
Okay, pretty straightforward. Mark, do we have any other questions from you for Andre?
Yeah, look, I just wanted to sort of paint a picture in my head. If I had CSP licensing and I had an Azure subscription and I was there, and let's say I had an issue with one of my virtual machines, for example, and I can't sort of fix it, I need to get support. Can I go through the portal, the new portal, portal.azure.com, and click on the little question mark at the top and follow my nose through the normal channels and go get log a support request?
There's a couple of different levels of support. I guess the Azure portal primarily has been designed mainly for end customers. There hasn't really been too much in there for partners. How it's generally expected to work is either the CSP, which is Bripe in this instance, would lodge the ticket with Microsoft on your behalf, or the partner would have what Microsoft call advanced support for partners, which would then give them support. It's a partner level support agreement where Microsoft will agree to support all of their customers, and they'll get a certain number of calls and support hours every month or every year that they can draw down, and they can choose which customer to use it for. Alternatively, the partner can purchase Microsoft-based support on a per subscription and per customer basis. In a similar fashion, how if you were to just put your credit card down on Azure.com, the free support, the only support you really get is account and billing support. You don't actually get technical support when you purchase it on a credit card from Microsoft directly. That's an extra cost. What you can do in CSP is go to your CSP provider, and they have a support agreement with Microsoft where they can lodge that ticket on your behalf.
So that process, though, when I'm, say, an end user and then go to the service provider and they can lodge it on the behalf, do you have to go to another portal or another website to lodge that support ticket, or is it done through the portal? It knows that subscription CSP, it knows who the provider is. I can lodge the ticket using the normal mechanism, but rather than going through the Microsoft, it lodges it through to the provider. Is that how it works?
No, you can't lodge it in the portal, because the support agreements in the CSP program are at the partner level. So essentially, Microsoft doesn't really know that the customer is supported, because it's the partner that gets the support. Microsoft only finds out about the customer when the partner asks for help with customer ABC. And there is a separate portal for partners to lodge these support tickets.
Okay. All right. So with the support, is it similar to the BPOS days where you've got like level one, like where before it gets escalated to Microsoft, the CSP provider can sort of provide that sort of support if they need to?
Yeah, so there's some basic troubleshooting that we provide. So, for example, if a virtual machine is unresponsive, you go through the very basic notions of checking boot diagnostics, seeing what's on the output of the virtual machine, restart the virtual machine, or redeploy the virtual machine to a different host in the Azure data center. Once you've gone through the basic troubleshooting steps and it's still unresponsive and having issues, the nature of Azure or any sort of cloud service is then you have to go to the service provider, which in this case would be Microsoft, and then they can run further diagnostics from their side.
Okay, just one final one before I'll hand back over to Rob. Is with the support process versus, say, direct, like pay-as-you-go, for example, is there any type of slowdown when it comes to going through, like, the process? Like, I log a support ticket through my CSP provider. They look at the ticket. They try and help in the first instance if they can. If they can or they can't, they then push it through to, say, Microsoft. Do you guys have, like, a special area in Microsoft where you push the tickets through to get, like, priority support to speed up the whole two-layer support sort of part of it?
When partners lodge support requests on our portal, we actually have direct API connectivity to Microsoft. So once a ticket is raised with us, that ticket is raised with Microsoft at the same time. So while we're waiting for Microsoft to respond to the tickets, we will then run the troubleshooting in that time.
Right.
And then, generally speaking, Microsoft will pick that ticket up and respond to it after we've done the troubleshooting. So they'll come to us, they'll say, what have you done? We'll say what the issue is, what troubleshooting's happened, and then they'll take it a step further. I guess where the benefit of what you get in CSP is ourselves, we actually have an escalation manager at Microsoft for support. If you're a larger partner and you have advanced support for partner, or you're a customer under an enterprise agreement with direct support agreements, you have escalation managers as well you can raise your issues with. What you don't have as a smaller partner is the escalation management from Microsoft. Because they're generally quite expensive, and if you've only got a couple of customers in running in Office 365 in Azure, it's generally not financially viable. It's a service you would really need on very few occasions, quite rarely. And we have that for partners to leverage through our agreement.
Okay. Excellent. So I'll hand back over to Rob.
Okay, so just two last questions from me, I think, before we probably round it up and let everybody get on with their day. But firstly, what about if I'm selling licenses in different regions? So let's take, for example, I have a corporation that is based in Australia, but maybe has a head office in Singapore, Hong Kong, or some other location. As a CSP in Australia, can I buy licenses and push them into those sort of locations or into different tenants, for example, that were homed originally in, say, Singapore?
No. It's quite intricate in terms of the terminology we need to use in this instance. If the concept of regions at Microsoft is basically countries that are close to one another. For Australia and the Australian region, we have Australia and Fiji. So a partner with a legal presence in Australia can sell to other Australian companies. They can also sell to Fijian companies, and the tenancy that they sell, the tenant would be based in the Australian data center. What that partner can't do is sell into Southeast Asia, so Singapore, Hong Kong, etc., etc. The Southeast Asia region is quite a bit larger. So if you were a partner in Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Once you have a legal presence there, you can then sell into any of the countries in Southeast Asia. So they're quite open in that sense. If an Australian partner wanted to sell into the Southeast Asia region, they would need to set up a legal presence in Southeast Asia and one of the countries there, and set up a separate CSP agreement with a CSP distributor in the same region as them. And then they'll be able to service customers in the Southeast Asia region.
Okay, all right. I do get that question occasionally, especially when you've got corporations working in multi-regions. So it's good to clear that up. Now, the last one from me is, I suppose, a bit of a summary if you want. What are the most common questions and misconceptions you hear from partners about the CSP program? You've obviously done a lot of traveling, spent a lot of time talking to partners, obviously answering a lot of questions. What are the sort of the top questions and misconceptions that you see partners asking you?
Questions and misconceptions. I don't think there's too many misconceptions around the CSP program. I think one of them is partners are not used to having a program that's so easy to deal with. In Southeast Asia in particular, the open licensing program has been very popular. And Rob, as you might know, the process for procuring licensing in open can be quite lengthy, where you would generate a purchase order, send it to your distributor, they send it to Microsoft, Microsoft processes that order, they populate the customer's VLSC with the license key, they send a confirmation back to the distributor, who sends a confirmation back to the partner, who then goes into VLSC, redeems the key, goes to the customer's admin center and redeems the key there. It's a very lengthy and quite a cumbersome process. It's something that can take 2 to 3 days quite easily. In the CSP program, we provide the license directly to the tenants. We have direct API connectivity into the Microsoft data centers. So when a partner comes and orders the license, as soon as they hit submit, the order takes about 5 to 6 seconds to be processed and for the licenses to be available. So what it actually is disbelief that they have so little work to do, given their experience in the open licensing program, and they're expecting to get a license key that you then go and redeem. But that doesn't exist anymore because the license is provided directly to the tenant. So it takes a little while for partners to come out of a quite a complex program to something as simple like CSP, and they just don't believe that it's that easy. That's actually probably one of the biggest challenges. It's a good challenge to have, and once customers are familiar with CSP, they understand that it truly is that easy. The biggest challenge, I think, really is Azure. A lot of customers and partners alike have provisioned their customers in Office 365. They've got the full tenancy. When they've gotten them provisioned Azure, they've actually gotten provisioned it under a personal account, so what's called a live ID. And that actually sits outside of their Office 365 tenancy. So it's been difficult to manage to have a separate login for 365 and Azure. In CSP, because we put the licensing or the subscription directly into the tenant, the same tenant that 365 is in, it's just that transition, moving partners and customers off of personal accounts for Azure into work accounts is quite a labor-intensive process. But once partners are in that environment and they're procuring new tenancies in a CSP program, they find their life and their administrative overheads effectively go down, and then they just find it a lot easier to use.
All right. Well, Andre, we better wrap things up because we're coming to the end. But look, thanks very much for your time today and coming on to the podcast. Very much appreciate it, because CSP is definitely a hot topic at the moment. While we wrap up, if you can sort of let people know the best way to get in contact with you.
Yeah, sure. My blog is akon.cloud, so Andrey Korenkov on cloud. I think it's kind of cool. Or Twitter, akon, so akon cloud. Probably one of the two best ways to get a hold of me.
Nice and easy. They're both the same, aren't they?
Yeah.
Akon cloud.
Nice and simple. Has a good ring to it, I think.
It does. It does. Rob, have you got anything else before we call it a day?
No, I think that we're pretty much done. We, again, thank Andre for his time. We thank Mark for asking all the Azure side of the questions, and hopefully that everybody who has listened has got benefit out of it. Don't forget, you can also ping Andre with some specifics, and also Mark and myself around Office 365 and Azure. We take the opportunity to thank all our listeners and really appreciate them taking the time to obviously spend probably half an hour, 40 minutes with us on a regular basis. But no, that's all from me, Mark. Do you want to sign off for us?
All right. Bye, everybody.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.